Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's show. I know it's one that I've been looking forward to, and plenty of you have been looking forward to as well. So I'm excited to have two brilliant minds with me today who are going to be talking about logic. So Graham Priest, I'm sure many of you are familiar with his work in logic on dialetheism. Rob Koons is a metaphysician predominantly. I've got two of their sort of books on various topics if people want to, you know, check these out and go and investigate some of these topics from the ground up. And there's more in-depth stuff out there as well for those who are interested, but that's probably more at my level. So the topic for today is basically going to be, is there one true logic to rule them all? And sort of, if so, what is it? And before we get started, there's some sort of defining of terms and so forth that we have to do. So I was wondering, well, do you want to go first, Graham, in just talking a little bit about, well, what is logic, first of all?
Okay, so I'm happy to do that. I think the first thing to be said is that the word logic is highly ambiguous, and it's been used by different philosophers to mean many different things. We could spend a whole hour talking about the various meanings. That's not going to be very profitable. I think what would profit us most is to fix on one of these meanings, which is more or less the way that contemporary logicians understand the word. Logic is about what follows from what. So if you've got certain views, information, premises, then you can infer other things from these. And logic will tell you what follows and what doesn't. So that's a fairly neutral definition of logic, at least the sense of logic I think it will pay us to talk about. And of course, we can have various theories about what follows from what and why. If you look at the history of Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy, you'll find many theories, and they don't all agree with each other. And so logicians and philosophers disagree about this. So the standard state of play is roughly this. Since about the beginning of the 20th century, I think there's been a fairly orthodox view about what the answer to that question is, although it comes in many flavors. And the view is that the correct view is something called classical logic, which is something of a misnomer, because it was invented by Frege and Russell around the turn of the 20th century. But if you do a first course in logic, that's what you're going to be taught probably. And something like that is the orthodox view, that theory gets it right in terms of what follows from what. However, that's becoming increasingly contentious, I think, with the discovery and investigation of what's now normally called non-classical logics by various logicians, especially, I mean, these go back also to the beginning of the 20th century, but I think most work has been done on them in the second half of the 20th century. So there are many live debates about whether the theory of what follows from what provided by classical logic is correct. And we can go into those debates if you want, but for the moment, let's just recall that they're there. That raises two other questions. The first is, how do you know which theory is right? So that's a question of epistemology. Traditionally, it's been assumed that logic is kind of distinctive. You can find an answer a priori. And this is the view that's associated with Kant, for example. That's one possibility. Another view that's gaining popularity amongst some philosophers of logic is a view that goes by the rather ugly name of anti-exceptionism. And the view is that logic is a theory. It's a theory about what follows from what. And when you evaluate which theory is correct, you do so by the standard criteria of theory choice. So adequacy to the data is most important, but there are other things like simplicity, unifying power, etc. All the criteria that beloved of philosophers of science, essentially you apply those. That's a view that I actually subscribe to. That's one question that is raised in this issue. Another is whether, in fact, there is a uniquely right answer to this question. Basically, philosophers have assumed that there is a right answer to the question of what follows from what and why, difficult it might be to find it. But we've seen some philosophers in the last 30 years, I guess, arguing that for a view called logical pluralism, which is roughly the view that there can be more than one correct account of logic, or derivatively, more than one correct logic. That's an interesting debate. I'm not persuaded by the arguments. I guess I'm still a rather old-fashioned logical monist in these views. But that's a debate that's been going on in the literature now for maybe 20 or 25 years. So that's just putting some ground perspective in play on some of the things we may discuss. I'm happy to hand over to Rob at this point.
Yeah, do you want to do something similar, Rob? I mean, feel free to go back and forth as well. I want it to be, you know, flow naturally.
Right. Yeah, I think there's quite a bit of common ground here. So I start with Aristotle, I guess. And actually, I think Aristotle and Quine are on the same page on a certain point here, which is that logic is something, it's not conventional, right? It's not something that human beings invent, right? And indeed, it is... To assert logical truths, especially to assert their necessity, is to say something about the world, about reality. Right? I think that also pushes me towards a more modest position, right? In the sense that, there's going to be a true logical theory which will correspond to some deep metaphysical facts about the world, So why can't it be conventional? I guess I think that Quine's argument in Truth by Convention is very convincing, which is you need logic to infer the particular applications of a convention, given that conventions are open-ended and can apply to infinite number of cases. We need logic to apply those conventions to particular cases, so therefore logic itself cannot be conventional. I think for a similar reason, I wouldn't go all the way, I'm jumping around a little bit, I'm sorry, but I wouldn't go all the way with what Graham called the anti-exceptionalist view. I mean, I guess my position is some kind of hybrid of a priorism and a more theoretical virtue picture. Because if you put all of your eggs in the theoretical virtues picture, right, then again, we're going to run into this question of, I mean, one of the crucial virtues of a theory is that its consequences are true, and it has lots of consequences, right, and so on. And those are logical notions, right? So there's a difficulty here of either an infinite regress or a kind of vicious circularity, perhaps, in trying to use, in using logic to evaluate theories of logic. I think there are going to have to be certain fixed points which are a priori in character. But then on other points, perhaps, we can look to these theoretical virtues to choose between different logical theories. So I think I'm not entirely disagreeing with Graham, but there's maybe some significant disagreement there at that point. Let's see. On the classical logic issue, I mean, one thing, of course, to point out is that those early people, Frege, Russell in particular, didn't have any kind of modal logic. Didn't do any sort of temporal logic either, and so conditional logics, right? So from that point of view, I think the Frege-Russell kind of classical logic was at the very least, incomplete. Peirce had it much better, I think. Peirce had a much more comprehensive picture of law of logic in his work, which has unfortunately neglected for a long time. And certainly, once you start going and looking at modal logic and other logics, you do get lots of competing theories, right? So there's not the same kind of consensus about the correct logical theory there that you would find in the simple sort of predicate kind of case. So I don't know, maybe that helps clarify my position a little bit. I mean, I do think on the pluralist issue, I do think there are certain cases where logic has some application. Where one has to use different logics in different applications. So in particular, I've done quite a bit of work on causation, And in that context, I think it's actually quite useful to use something like strong, clean A logic, a kind of three-valued incomplete logic on that particular, on those, for those particular cases, even if one's theory about logic in general is more classical, more two-valued in various cases. I guess one more thought, I'll say one more thing yet before I can pass over. And that is, you know, the notion of what follows from what, right? Is itself a little ambiguous, I think. So one could interpret that simply modally. So in other words, what necessitates what, right? And I think that's too broad to characterize logic, in my sense, in my view. There are things that might well be, you know, maybe having water necessitates having H2O in one's glass. That's not a logical inference, right? So I think that so the really interesting question is, how do you narrow, right, the scope of necessitation to logical necessitation, right? And I think part of that has to do with some sort of normative status that these logical truths and logical inferences have. And there's something irrational about, at least in most cases, neglecting or ignoring the law of excluded middle or the law of contradiction in a way that isn't irrational to doubt whether water is H2O, at least in a situation without any particular evidence. So I think that normative issue is quite important to think about.
I think that's really helpful from both of you. I don't know if there's something you immediately want to come in there, Graham. What I want to clarify is, because of where some of the disagreements are, do you think that you're both signed up to the same maybe like standards of disagreement for making progress on this issue?
I don't know. We'll see, won't we?
Okay. Yes.
I'd be surprised if we differed, actually. I mean, given what you've just said, Rob, it's not clear to me that we disagree a lot about the big picture. We may disagree about some of the details, but I suspect that your views and mine sort of massage into each other reasonably comfortably. One issue you did raise, which I didn't raise, and it's an important one, is this. You raised the question of what makes a theory of logic true, as opposed to how we know it's true. Okay, mm-hmm. But those are separate issues, though. Of course, they're interconnected.
Right.
And you indicated some kind of relationship between validity and reality. And there's got to be such a thing, of course. I don't think, you know, anyone's going to deny that. Anyone who says, look, this inference is valid, the moon is a satellite of the Earth, therefore Beijing is the capital of South Africa, that's got to be crazy, because the premise is true and the conclusion is false. So, you know, the facts about reality place clear constraints on what inference is valid. Now, there's a more interesting question, which you may have a view on, is whether the nature of validity places constraints on reality, put it the other way around, as, for example, Wittgenstein does in the Tractatus. That's an interesting question. We can explore that if you like. But, I mean, so far, I don't think in anything that either of us has said, there's an enormous difference looming.
Yeah, that's my sense too. Having read your work, I can certainly, you know, understand where you're coming from, follow the arguments, maybe don't agree on every case. But I think that's more to do with judgments about, you know, what's most important in particular contexts. So yeah, I think that's right.
So it feels kind of, I don't know, like, I don't mean to bring out like attention then, but something like, in the case of dialetheisms or things that might have both truth values, you know, right? Are you going to be signed up to them as well, Rob? Or is that going to be like a major area of this, that they might exist in some cases?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I'm curious about how big a difference there might be here. Because I remember Graham, at least in one place, saying that that there's some strong presumption in favor of the law of non-contradiction in particular cases, that there's some sort of burden of proof that has to be met, maybe a pretty high bar, a burden of proof to be met to make the case for a particular contradiction. That seemed to me basically right. And I think I might set the bar very high such that it's almost impossible to find cases. particular cases where I would embrace a contradiction. On the other hand, if you just ask me abstractly, are there any true contradictions? I don't know, right? I mean, I'd have to say, well, let's see, right? let's investigate it. I wouldn't rule it out absolutely. But I do think there's some pretty strong presumption against it, at least in particular cases. And that has to do with, I guess, my sense that, and maybe this goes, I should address something that Graham just said. I do think of logic, or at least as something closely related to logic, as a kind of constraint on reality. So I think that, I think the logical truths are, again, necessary truths. And that those necessary truths themselves are part of the basic structure of reality. So I'm pretty strong realist about modality in general, and logical modality in particular. So insofar as I think there's good grounds, both a priori and a posteriori, for thinking that the world is surprisingly unified and self-consistent, that creates a strong presumption in favor of classical logic.
Yeah, I had assumed that we would disagree about, I mean, given that we're both roughly monists, I had assumed that we'd disagree about what the one true logic is, okay? My own leanings are towards a paraconsistent logic, as you know, and yours, I had assumed, would be towards classical logic or some extension of it, some classical modal logic. Which sort of raises the question of, well, how do you address such debates? And one thing that would need to be addressed in a discussion of this is precisely the question of whether your logic should be able to tolerate contradictions. And dilithium is one of the reasons why that might be the case. I actually agree with what you say, that in theorizing about logic, there are many criteria, such as simplicity, non-ad hocness, and so on. And I'm happy to agree that a high degree of consistency is a pretty good mark. I think, for the most part, reality is consistent. Is that always so? Well, then we'd have to go into issues such as the sort of problem cases, right, such as paradoxes, such as motion, such as inconsistencies, and such as the limits of thought. You know, the sort of standard issues here. That's where one, I think, would need to pursue some of these issues. And of course, those are big issues too. But that's where I would see the debate going, over that particular constraint on the correct logic. You know, consistency, toleration.
Yeah, there's actually this one area where I think I'm really fully on board with paraconsistent logics and think they're essential, and that is in per impossibile kind of reasoning, which I think is pretty important. So there are lots of cases where we might want to reason about an impossible state of affairs, a metaphysically impossible state of affairs, and we might even want to reason about, you know, a self-contradictory state of affairs, even if I insist that those are impossible, right? We still might want to think about the implications of that. And in that kind of context, you need a paraconsistent logic. So there I'm going a little pluralistic, I guess, in the sense that that's a somewhat unusual context, right? And in that sort of setting, I think paraconsistent logic makes a lot of sense. Thinking about the actual world or, you know, potential worlds that we might actually encounter, then I think I'm going to be more firmer on the classical picture.
Yeah. Well, per impossibile reasoning is coming back into fashion in logic, yeah. But of course it's a very traditional part of medieval logic, where you had whole theories of obligationes, where people could be given an impossible postulate obligation to defend. So, you know, what you're saying is actually, you know, a very ancient part of logic.
Yeah, that's right.
So is the idea sort of this then, Graham, that you've kind of spelled out that we need to decide which is the one true logic according to certain sort of theoretical virtues, and then that there's, in your view, this data point that isn't explained by a more classical logic, which is going to be, you know, actual contradictions existing in the world, you know, like maybe this sentence is false or whatever.
That is my view. Of course, there's a question about what the world is. Okay, is it, you know, a la Tractatus, everything that is the case? I'm happy to, you know, to subscribe to that view, but you might have other views. You might think of reality as comprising objects which may be maybe only concrete, or maybe concrete and abstract, or maybe something else. To discuss the world, we first have to tie down what we're going to mean by the world. But I do think that the world, at least in the sense of everything that is the case, is actually inconsistent. And that's what drives me to a paraconsistent logic. Anyway, at least that's my view.
If there is anything you want, yeah, I didn't know if you want to comment on that, Rob, or...
No, I think that makes sense. And so, maybe we should focus on some of the problem cases, right? So they're the paradoxes, both semantic and, I guess, the set theoretic paradoxes. We can make a distinction there. There's ontological vagueness, I guess. Is that an important one for you, Graham? And then and then time in general, as you say, change or just... I'm actually somewhat sympathetic to it in the case of time. Kit Fine has a paper, I forget the title, where he talks about fragmentalism, where the thought is that, the world at different points in time are actually inconsistent with each other, right? The rod is cold here and it's not cold, right? And that's in a sense, an inconsistency. I'm sympathetic to that, although, the traditional law of excluded middle in Aristotle is qualified to saying that something cannot both be and not be at the same time and in the same way. And so in a sense, it's conceding, right? That across time, there might well be sort of real inconsistencies in the world.
Yeah, look, I don't think that's terribly contentious. I mean, that something that can be the case at one time and not the case at another time is in a sense perfectly consistent. And as I say, not contentious.
No, I think it is pretty contentious, actually. Oh. I mean, four-dimensionalists would deny that, right? They would say you've got a temporal part that's cold and another temporal part that's not cold.
I see. Yeah. If you put that spin on it, that's true. But everybody's going to agree that the sun's shining now where we are and it won't be in 12 hours' time. I mean, that's everyone agrees on that. How you sort of message that into a theoretical position is a different question.
Right.
The data, that bit of data is not contentious. I mean, when you mention time, actually, I thought you meant something different, which is the tangles we get into when we talk about the nature of time, and especially the flow of time.
Right. There's because, that, yeah.
You might actually come to the conclusion that time itself is an inconsistent thing, because of the sort of paradoxes that seem to arise when we consider, especially things like the flow of time. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that an inconsistent theory of time is the best theory. It may well not be. But I do find some of these puzzles of time genuinely puzzling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, McTaggart, argued that time was inconsistent. I guess basis, he wanted to say it was unreal as well.
Yes, exactly. So his modus tollens might be my modus ponens.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's worth considering. And the reason I mentioned it is, that a lot of the ways of getting around the apparent contradiction aren't really very plausible. So there's the temporal parts kind of picture, which I don't think is very attractive. And then the other option really is some kind of relational view that, the rod is hot in relationship to the one time and cold in relation to another time. And as Lewis points out, that's sort of weird because you would have thought that hot and cold were intrinsic properties, not relations to times in some way. So if you say, well, it's, let's tense the copula, in a way that's sort of admitting that there's a real contradiction there, right? It is cold, time tenseless in some tenseless sense, and is not cold, right? It's just that, one way to take that would be to say it's cold according to one point in time and not cold, according to this other point of time. And those two points in time are actually, in conflict with each other logically.
Maybe you know, certain cases that are sort of more purely logical, I suppose, as opposed to having quite a lot of kind of fleshed out metaphysical commitments might be clearer right. for considering.
Yeah. Some of them get pretty technically pretty difficult.
The obvious one that we would discuss in that context, I guess, is the one that Rob mentioned, the paradox of self-reference. We can go over that if you like, although, as Rob said, the details get very technical very fast. Given Rob's interests, maybe it would be more appropriate to focus on some of the metaphysical stuff rather than the kind of logical esoterica.
Okay, sure.
I mean, I've written about the liar paradox too, so it's not like I'm not interested in that.
I'm certainly not yeah. against going into it, and I know you're yeah. not. I just mm-hmm. wonder yeah. how far we could get in a context like this before yeah. we start losing people.
Yeah, yeah, that's maybe true. I mean, I guess I'll just say something about what I see as the two most popular or two most attractive options, right? One of which is dialethism, right? So I'll raise that up to the level of the main competitor. And the other view I think that's attractive is some kind of contextualist view about truth and knowledge and other things. So there isn't really a single notion of truth, but rather a family, kind of range of things that are analogically related to each other in various ways. So that when I say this sentence is not true, you know, we have to disambiguate or take into account the context in which it's being said. In some contexts, that statement is true. In others, it's false. So, so if I say that, I mean, I guess I'm following here a view that's very similar to Barwise Etchemendi's view in The Liar, right? So to say that something is true is always to say it in relationship to some part of the world, what they call a situation, right? And so if I say this sentence is not true in S, right, then that fact can't itself be encoded in S, right? You have to diagonalize out into a larger context. So it isn't true in S, right? But it is true in some larger context, S prime, once you've stepped back and looked at the situation. So I mean, there's a pretty big price to pay there, right? Which is that truth is not univocal, right? Or you know, neither is knowledge and these other kind of related things. But you know, I think that's not to my mind not terribly disturbing or surprising even.
Those are the two theories of truth you mentioned are certainly on the table. Okay, I was a bit surprised that you singled out those two as the most plausible, because my sense of the literature at the moment is that the contextualist theory is not so popular. That the most popular view is the gap theory, that the sentences are neither true nor false. And I think the two most plausible theories are the gap theory and the glut theory, dialethism. And I'd have put the contextual theory as a third. But you know, this is a matter of judgment, and I don't know there's much to disagree about there. One of the strongest arguments against non-consistent views for me has always been extended paradoxes.
Right.
So if you've got some escape mechanism to take you out of the contradiction, it always seems possible to build that into a different version by quantifying over, but by saying, what about the sentence which says it's false or neither true nor false? What about the sentence that says it's false in all contexts? However you want to phrase it. And it always seems possible to produce such a thing. So you don't seem to have solved the problem, you just seem to have shelved it or pushed it elsewhere. Now, of course, you know, people will disagree about that. The gap theorists will disagree, contextualists are likely to disagree. But those are reasons that I've always found a dialethic view a kind of better in the end, because you just buy the contradiction and it's the end of the story.
Yeah, but don't you think the glut theory faces a similar problem?
No, I don't.
So I say this sentence is both true and false.
Well,
it's itself both true and false. You're saying?
Sure. You're going to get a contradiction. I agree with that. Okay, but given that the theory is that certain contradictions are acceptable, and contradictions are going to arise when you've got self-reference, it seems to me that that's what you'd expect. I mean, that move is not available to a consistent theorist just because they're trying to avoid contradiction. But the move is available to a dilutheist just because the aim is not to get rid of contradictions, it's to, shall we say, domesticate them.
Right, but I mean, but won't you be saying that the contradiction is just simply true in this case and not also false?
Well, that depends on how the truth predicate works, and in particular whether it commutes with negation. Okay, so now we're starting to get into more technical details, so I don't know how long we want to pursue this. But depending on what your view of how truth relates to negation is and some other questions, you are going to get into contradictions. One of those contradictions might actually be that there are no contradictions. And of course there are. I mean,
right.
That's a view that I put on the table way back when I floated dilutheism in the 70s.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't be news if it's true. Of course, whether it's true is something we can contest. But you're not going to escape contradictions, meta-contradictions, meta-meta-contradictions, you know, however you want to phrase it.
Right. Yeah, I guess, to be honest, that's the point exactly where I start pulling back from the dilutheism, right? I mean, it's one thing to be able to have the contradictions at the object level and then, you know, be able to say goodbye to them forever. But the idea that they keep coming back so that, you know, almost anything you say, I have to say, well, would he also embrace the negation? In many cases, yeah. The answer is yes. And that worries me, I guess.
That's perfectly correct.
Yeah.
I mean, if whatever you say, I say, if any contradiction you point out, I say, I accept that. That's intellectually shoddy, right? I don't want to get
it's there. Worrying, yeah.
What is necessary to address this issue is something which is not, that rules out this kind of ad hoc move. So what will rule out this picture is a theory of truth, not necessarily the metaphysical grounding of truth, but at least the properties of truth, such that because you've got this theory of truth based on some paraconsistent logic, you can actually control where the contradictions arise. So you can say, okay, it's legitimate to expect them here, but not there. And that's going to rule out the kind of ad hocery that you're worried about, which I agree is not something you would want to do.
Yeah. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I wonder if you could just walk me through how the liar. Inconsistent liar. So the thing that said this sentence is both true and false, right? It looks to me that your theory is going to be that statement is true, simpliciter, right? And then I'm going to get wait, and then it's also false. So it looks. It just seems to me that at the meta level, you're not going to be able to say what you really want to say, are you? I mean, how do you get?
So we could walk through the argument, but you're going to get something like it's true and false, and it's true and not false. And if you want to call that true simpliciter, that's fine.
Right.
Do I want to say that? Is that a contradiction I'd buy? Yes. Okay. Do I want to say therefore that situation is no good? No, I don't want to say that. I mean, a lot of people who've been tempted by paraconsistent logic, I think have been tempted by the view that it's okay to handle inconsistency, but you want your own view ultimately to be consistent. I think that's a chimera, okay? If you're serious, you should expect your own view to be inconsistent. And so contradictions of the kind that you're gesturing at, I think, are, you know, par for the course.
Right. I know at one point, I think you in one of your papers, you suggested that arithmetic itself might be inconsistent. Is that still something you consider to be possible? Yeah, that I find pretty hard to believe as well, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's an interesting issue, and of course, it's more technical issues.
Yeah.
But what I'm not suggesting is that something like piano arithmetic is inconsistent. That's not
correct. Right.
What I'm suggesting,
the truth about the numbers themselves. The arithmetical truths about the numbers consistently.
That's true. But of course, you know, as you know, I'm sure that there are paradoxes about provability.
Right.
The sentence is not provable. And then we're starting to get into paradoxes that might appear in logic, in arithmetic. It just depends on whether you think the provability predicate in the appropriate sense, and thereby hangs a tail, is it's not expressible in more familiar arithmetical machinery. Okay, so there are lots of issues there about Gödel's theorem and so on, but you're right. I mean, this is where some of that discussion goes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I wonder, I mean, there's a few things that you both could talk about where there might be differences as well. I wonder if moving the topic onto something slightly different, like whether, you know, we should sign up to something like the principle of explosion, for example, in a logical system. Is there going to be like difference between the two of you in an area like that? No.
No, I think we're going to agree on that. Yeah. That, you know, again, if you want to reason about per impossible like kind of situations, you don't want an explosion to happen. So I think, yeah, I think paraconsistent logics make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So the disagreement there would not be, we both agree you need it in per impossible situations. I think I would think that some of the things which are per impossible, but some of the things that Rob thinks are per impossibile are not for me. That's probably a major disagreement.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's interesting then thinking. So I suppose maybe I should frame this question then. I think perhaps we all agree that the default position that one adopts as one sort of learns logic is this kind of classical view, you know, because that's just the way you taught it. But is there a kind of, you know, like a kind of principled reason that can be appealed to for accepting something as a dilithium instead of, you know, going with some other view, like there's a gap in logic here or something like that? Like what it, because I think someone sort of adopts that point of view, but then, okay, they might sign up to, well, if there's some data that my language can't fit, I should, you know, adopt a different theory that can fit that data. But what is it that should push them towards accepting that, I suppose?
Right. So you're pushing us back to the methodology or epistemology kind of question, right? Yeah. And I guess I'd make the point I made earlier, which is that I think there is an a priori element to this evaluation, that that you can't go entirely theory choice about theory choice kind of model, because you need to be able to say what follows from a theory. Right? And that's got to be a kind of fixed point for this evaluation. And some of that has to come from the a priori. And I guess the law of non-contradiction strikes me as an area where the a priori status is pretty plausible, right? Especially in the sense, and giving back to Aristotle, that, you know, if you say P and then you also say not P, and you sort of stick to those on any, you know, on any particular case, it's not now clear to me what you're saying. Right. I mean, whether you're actually succeeding in asserting anything, right? Because assertion, I think, involves always, you know, excluding something, and here, you know, there's no exclusion that happens. So that's I guess that's the worry I have from a classical point of view.
Yeah, so many issues there. Look, let's start with your thoughts, Nathan. How do you know when a contradiction is true? Okay, how do you know when anything's true? You look at the evidence, okay? And one thing we've learned from 20th century philosophy of science is there's no algorithm for this. You consider any individual case on its merits, and I'm afraid that the same is true for contradictions, okay? Now, when you're considering the inconsistency of anything that's philosophically substantial, part of your evidence is going to be this. We have different theories about something. Maybe it's about truth, maybe it's about motion, maybe it's about time. They're always going to be completing theories. Some of these are consistent, some of these are not. Then you look at the best theory by the criteria of theory choice. So we're not talking about theory choice in logic. We're talking about theory choice in other things here, right? And it may be that in the end, a consistent theory is the best theory. It may be in the end that an inconsistent theory is the best theory. But that's a methodological issue of how you might go about discussing whether a particular contradiction is true or not. It's going to be embedded in a theory of some complexity. Okay. Now, Rob's point is kind of interesting.
Would it help to repeat it?
No, I've got it. I'm just trying to organize my thoughts into something simple and coherent. Let me just make two points. The first is that what's a priori true is something of a movable feast. So if you look at the things that have been held to be a priori true in the history of Western philosophy, let alone Eastern philosophy, then people change their minds about this. For example, in the Middle Ages, it was held to be a priori true that a Christian God exists. Now, I guess not many contemporary philosophers will think that, even if they think that God exists. So what is a priori true is something we might well argue about. So that's one way the debate might go. The second point is a more substantial, let's just call it a different point. The point that Rob raised about if you say P and not P, what do you mean? Well, look, what you mean is bloody obvious. It's what I say, okay? So when people worry about this, and they do, they don't worry, they're not worried so much about the meaning of what it says, but what I might mean by saying it, okay? If I tell you, look, I can look out my window, I can see the Empire State Building, and I can't see the Empire State Building, legitimately say, what the fuck do you mean? Okay. So what game am I playing when I do this? Okay, that's a good question. And to answer that kind of question, you've got to look at the topic, maybe truth, to see what game I'm playing with my theory of truth. Your observations are based in many interesting questions. That's just a thought on two of them, okay?
Yeah. On your first point, are you being dismissive of the a priori, or are you just pointing out that it's difficult, like all of epistemology, right?
Well, look, okay. So first we might need to think about what you mean by a priori. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, here's a sentence. The cat's walking around the room. Is that grammatical? Yeah. Did I have to examine the world to determine that? No, I just reflected on it. I don't have any problem with something as being a priori in that sense. There are other senses of a priori I might have a problem with, but not that one. Judgments about grammaticality for most native speakers are a priori. We sort of just think about them, but we make mistakes. You know, there are several examples from linguistics where people are inclined to think that things are not grammatical. And then when you explain the rules to them, they get this aha moment and they see they are. So there are things called midpoint insertion, where you break up a clause by inserting something in the middle. And if you do this for two or three nestings, it just doesn't sound grammatical until you are given the parsing of it. So, you know, a priori judgments in that sense can certainly be fallible. Sure. Okay, I don't know if that addresses your question or you want to take it further.
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, we could potentially be wrong about anything, whether it's a priori or a posteriori. And of course, it's hard. It's always hard to settle these things. If I say, look, I just think it's a priori, obviously true, that the law of non-contradiction holds universally, then you know, yeah, it's hard. I mean, in a way, it's difficult for me to justify that claim.
Right? Sure. Reasons give out somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe there, but yeah. I do think that once a view that you think is a priori has been challenged, at least behoves a person to think why they find it a priori. Mm-hmm. I mean, these views don't come from nowhere. So many of the things we believe because we're taught. Mm-hmm. Often the things we're taught are true, and that's fine. But why do many people believe the principle of non-contradiction? The Aristotelian arguments are pretty shonky, okay, and most contemporary commentators on Aristotle would agree on that. So it wasn't as though he settled the matter. And most people have subscribed to it since. Now, are there good reasons for that? Or is that just a matter of a way the Western tradition has educated people? That's an open question. I've never been able to make up my mind on this, but I think it's a question that's worth thinking about.
I forgot what the second point was you made. Could you remind me of that? And
let's yeah, I've got one too.
Hello. Yes, yes.
Maybe yeah. Someone in the chat if they can. Yeah. Remember, because
I'm not going to get it fast either. So maybe yeah. We should move on.
Yeah, terrible hosting because I, you know, I should be keeping track of those things, but I've been engrossed kind of listening to the conversation. If people want to put some questions in the chat as well, and I can field them to our guests, there's a few already a bit further up, and a lot of people saying that they're very happy listening into this conversation as well. So thank you both for making, you know, what you're communicating very clear for people and interesting for them. Also, so yeah, there's a thank you from Ash. A question maybe that's not so much to do with logic per se. Relay Theology has asked, not totally related to logic, but should non-atheist philosophers of religion engage more in the innovative work defending theism by Kuhn's, Proust, Rasmussen, and other theists? I'm not sure what your thoughts are on that. I mean,
I say yes, right?
Have we got some more questions further down? Oh, what does Priest think about innovations in logic used to develop modal/Gödelian ontological arguments and modal cosmological arguments put forward by Proust, Kuhn, Rasmussen, and others?
Okay, so probably the most interesting version of the ontological argument, it was produced by Gödel. It's a version of Leibniz's argument, and it shares the same problems in the end. We could discuss that, but it's a question of the consistency of perfections, and there's a question of how you cash that out. Anyway, that's a technical issue, and it's a bit difficult to go into. If you're trying to prove the existence of a Christian God a priori, then the ontological argument is the only one that can possibly succeed. All the others have contingent premises. So the cosmological argument has contingent premises. The most popular version of the cosmological argument, I think at the moment, is the fine-tuning argument, which observes that the fundamental constants of our cosmos have to be apparently have certain values, and those values must lie within very narrowly defined margins for there to be a stable cosmos at all. That's the sort of guts of the fine-tuning argument. And that argument has itself been subjected to lots of criticism for various considerations concerning probability distributions and so on. Again, you know, these are technical questions. But I find that the kind of standard replies to to fine-tune the argument and to the most plausible argument of the ontological argument pretty plausible.
Yeah, I would put the fine-tuning in the teleological category, actually. I mean, if you use the Kantian labels, right, of ontological, cosmological, and teleological, then the cosmological arguments are the arguments to a kind of necessary first cause. And that's the sort of thing, again, that Proust and Rasmussen and I and others have been working on recently quite a bit.
Do you have some modern versions? You're probably right. I should have called that a teleological argument. Mm-hmm. That came to mind because I think it's probably one of the most popular arguments for the existence of God amongst theists at the moment. Maybe I'm wrong, but you can tell me. I'm not familiar with modern versions of the cosmological argument. I'm afraid my knowledge stops at Aquinas. So maybe you can tell us something about the modern versions.
It's hard to summarize real quickly, but I wrote about this in 97 in the American Philosophical Quarterly, and then there's been a kind of a cottage industry since then of work on it. The idea is that there's some kind of principle of sufficient reason or causal principle that says that every the version I prefer, every plurality of causable things has a cause that's distinct from the plurality. And so that gets you pretty quickly to an uncausable thing.
Okay.
And then you get to God from that. So that's the quick version. Okay. There's lots of variations on that, of course.
All right. So essentially it's an argument from the principle of sufficient reason.
Yeah, or something in that neighborhood. Okay. That's right. Yeah.
That the principle of sufficient reason has come back into vogue for a number of reasons. There's a really nice book by the Yale philosopher on the principle of sufficient reason. And I'm now blanking on his name, which is abysmal because I've reviewed the book.
Yeah, I know you mean too. I'm blanking on it as well.
Okay, it'll come back. It's a really nice book.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I'm sort of skeptical of the principle of sufficient reason for various reasons.
Not for no reason. Yeah. Sorry. I don't mean to. I was just making a joke.
Here's one obvious question, which there may be a perfectly fine answer to. If you're going to get to an uncaused cause, I mean, is that going to be a counterexample to the principle of sufficient reason? Because,
right.
Is that itself something that violates the principle of sufficient reason?
Yeah. Well, the version that I mentioned at the beginning, right, was that every plurality of causable things has a cause. That gets you to something that's intrinsically uncausable. The principle obviously wouldn't apply to that. But there are other versions that are even stronger, right? That like every fact whatsoever has an explanation, right? That's the strongest possible version. And then you have to, obviously the issue is what sort of facts are self-explanatory or have a kind of explanation from nothing, so to speak. And those would then be the point that you reach. You might think that if I make a particular free choice, choose chocolate over vanilla in a particular case, the fact that I chose chocolate, let's say, is explained by the fact that I have free will and I chose chocolate. So in a sense, there's a bit of a circularity there, but it's a reasonable kind of circularity.
Okay, so there are a couple of issues here. The first is that we need to get clearer on what principle of sufficient reason is an issue here.
Yeah.
A second question which looms is, supposing you can use it to establish the existence of something, what exactly have you established the existence of?
Right.
Okay. Both those are interesting questions.
Yeah. Proust and I have an article in Phil Studies this last year where we argue that for a particular version of the PSR, and argue that if you don't have it, you fall into a kind of global empirical skepticism. So that you have to, there has to be a kind of presumption, at least, that any finite thing has a cause. So that's this kind of strategy I've been pushing for quite a few years now, the kind of epistemological strategy. And the other one is, we call this the gap problem, although it's maybe a misnomer, maybe the canyon problem is a better term for it, right? I mean, how do you get from the first cause to all the characteristics of God? And, yeah, there's a lot of work actually on that these days, because, a lot of metaphysicians now are accepting that there probably is some kind of necessary first cause. And so now the interesting question is, where, you know, what are the characteristics that it has?
I don't know if you, there are a few more questions in the chat if you guys want to continue talking about this particular point or move on. So
it's up to you. I'm
happy to take some more questions from the chat. I mean, you know, there are lots of interesting issues here, but I think we would need to sit down and hammer through some of the details to really make any progress on them.
Awesome. So a question here that's put forward for you, Graham, is, can there be physically impossible shapes?
It might depend on what you mean. We can certainly draw them, you know, the Escher diagrams and so on. Can you build one of the Escher diagrams? I don't think so. I was just wondering why I think that. Well, I suppose if someone knocked on my door and brought out a box and said, hey, have a look at this, and it was a real realization of an Escher diagram, I'd be gobsmacked. But I guess if it wasn't a hoax or an illusion, I'd believe it. But I think it would have to be inconsistent. And as we've already talked about, there have got to be good reasons why, you know, you believe in an inconsistency.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, this brings out the point we talked about earlier, which is that there, at the very least, there's a strong presumption, right, against inconsistency in particular cases. I mean, isn't that the upshot of this example?
No, I think that's right.
Okay, so let's see. Yeah, Real Atheology, by the way, said sorry for starting a debate on the question about moving on to,
no problem,
on to God's existence. I wonder on that previous point about whether there could be a physically impossible shape, it, with regards to some of the differences about a priori knowledge, whether the fact that we can conceive of something or draw it but couldn't physically instantiate it would get into some of those differences that you were both talking about earlier as well.
Would it
be like a good candidate for, well, let's, well, so I suppose it's, it, that's theory laden itself, what I'm kind of thinking about there, right? Because it could be the case that someone just says, well, you think you're conceiving it, but you're just engaging in this kind of fictionalism or something. And I'm thinking more along the lines of, well, there's like this a priori mathematical truth that you're getting at, but obviously that's not the only option someone could go for what's being, you know, what is Escher drawing, or what's he got in mind that he's able to maybe convey to someone else who's a student of mathematics and sees the art or whatever. And, you know, do they get the same thing in mind? And if you have a commitment to that being kind of true, but it couldn't be physically instantiated, is that like a good, I'm not putting together a strict argument or something here. Just approximately, that's what I'm thinking.
I'm not sure that I understand the thought, but let me say this and you can tell me if I'm way off target. Look, if Rob and I look at an Escher diagram, I'm pretty sure that we see the same thing. It's what Escher intended, okay? And we see that it's a configuration that can't be realized in as standard space and time, okay? It's just nomically impossible. In that sense, we both grasp the same thing, although it's impossible. Does that address your worry, or am I way off target?
It's very close. Maybe that I was just thinking maybe this would be like a good, so let's say either in terms of like a Cartesian graph or a vector space or something, you go above four dimensions. So like I physically understand four dimensions because I've got some sort of idea of time and the three dimensions of space, right? But if I can do stuff in linear algebra with like 5, 6, 7, 8 dimensions, but I don't really understand what it is that I'm conceiving or how that could be physically instantiated in any sense. So does that mean, you know, whatever mental operations I'm performing there would be like good candidates for these like non-physical kind of a priori things that I'm getting at? Or I don't know.
I think maybe what you're saying is something like this, that what this brings out is that the conceivability to possibility connection in some sense is itself a fallible one, at least depending on how you understand conceivable. But, you know, I can conceive of the Escher diagram, but I don't necessarily accept that it's possible, right? And conversely, maybe I can't conceive of five dimensions, but think it is actually possible, right? So I forget, because a lot of people think, you know, there's an attempt for several hundred years, right, to collapse modality into conceivability in some way. And I think Graham and I might agree that to resist that. Actually, this raises a question for Graham, actually, that I had. So a lot of what we've been talking about is whether, you know, inconsistencies are impossible or not. But I'm wondering, I mean, are impossibilities themselves possible, right? I guess that would follow as well on your view. There might be things that are impossible but actual. Is that right?
Okay. First, I'd like to sort of clarify what you mean by impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, most people think of contradictions as impossible, and I think that they can be actual. So the notion of possibility is manifold, right? Metaphysical, logical, physical, deontological, epistemological. When we're talking about impossibility here, which are we talking about? Let's stick to metaphysical impossibility, yeah. Okay, assuming there to be such a thing. What makes an object metaphysically impossible? Well, I think the answer is that it's metaphysically impossible if it can only have its properties in a metaphysically impossible world. Okay, that just shuts the problem back one. That you want to know what is metaphysically metaphysically impossible world is. And then, you know, we might argue about this, but let's take as a first cut, a world is metaphysically impossible if it has the same laws of metaphysics as the actual world. So it's going to be something like compatibility with the laws of metaphysics, assuming there to be such things. So that's an approach to the problem, but no more.
Yeah. But I mean, this gets back into compatibility and, you know, in what sense, right? In classical logic and in a fair consistent logic.
Sure. No, that issue is there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But also, I mean, coming to this is a question that Nathan raised about imagination and possibility. The high dimension geometric spaces and the Escher diagram are really quite different, I think, because you shouldn't identify imaginability with visual imagination. You know, mathematicians imagine lots of things which have no visualization at all. And high dimensional geometric spaces don't come with any natural visual representation. The Escher diagram sure do, because you can see the damn things, right? So they raise quite different issues concerning the relationship between imagination and possibility. I mean, you know, high dimensional geometric spaces are perfectly possible. They're unimaginable with mathematical imagination, just not visually imaginable. The Escher diagram is visually imaginable, but certainly impossible, at least nomically. I mean, actually, this takes us back to a certain extent to per impossibile reasoning, which Rob raised, because one area of paraconsistent logic nowadays is the description of Escher type impossible drawings. So you look at the geometry of the thing and you want to describe it, and it's inconsistent. But you can give a perfectly coherent description, although it's inconsistent, of the geometry of the picture. And it's the inconsistency that tells you that it's impossible. So that's one modern application of paraconsistent logic, which fits in with what Rob was saying about per impossibile reasoning. We reason out what's in the diagram, what the description of the content of an Escher picture is, and that's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So a question that someone's put forward for you as well, Rob, is: could the principle of sufficient reason apply to the totality of concrete things?
Yeah, so again, it depends on how one formulates the PSR in the first place, whether you give it a kind of restricted version or the unrestricted version. So I prefer the more restricted version, which would say everything that is, let's say, a finite concrete thing, right, has a cause, or the totality of finite concrete things have causes. And then it wouldn't apply to, if there are any infinite concrete things like God, it obviously wouldn't apply to that. Or you could have a view in which you count certain things as being, again, self-explanatory, or there's versions of it in which you say anything that could possibly have an explanation of a certain kind does have such an explanation, and that gives you, you know, the fixed point you reach is something that couldn't possibly have such an explanation. So there, you know, there are different strategies here. So to some extent, it's a matter of taste, I think, because, I mean, whether you call these particular cases self-explanatory or cases that are reasonably excluded ab initio from the principle, often amounts to, I mean, sort of same reasons that will have to be given in both cases, I think.
Thanks for that.
Say that the Yale philosopher I was trying to remember was Michael Della Rocca.
Yes, right.
Who's got a really interesting book called The Parmenidean Ascent. Maybe I think descent is better, but he calls it ascent. And he argues that if you are really serious about the principle of reason, you end up with a Parmenidean world in which there are no distinctions. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a sort of a very extreme conclusion. Mm-hmm. But you certainly don't want to push the principle of reason, sufficient reason, too hard, unless you want to end up in that camp, I think.
Right, right. Yeah, it does get into questions about what explanation involves, right? Does the explanans have to necessitate the explanandum, for instance? And I'll argue no, right, in order to get that creation to be contingent, even though God is necessary.
So I've got two more questions. I'll just go with this one first. And then the last one is kind of, I think, something that might be good to end on, because it'll summarize the whole sort of conversation, I think. This first one then is question for Kunz and Priest. Thoughts on attempts by Geech and some later logicians when they defend a relative notion of identity? I mean, thoughts is...
It's not fresh in my mind, but I just remember that in the end, I didn't find it workable. And so I ended up not going with that. At least I couldn't get my mind around the idea that two things could be identical qua F but not qua G. I mean, they're either identical or they aren't. So I wasn't a big fan of it.
Yeah. Look, I don't think that the Geech has had much traction. And the obvious worry is that what Geech is, the notion that Geech is tracking is same kind. Okay, which is a perfectly legitimate notion. It's just distinct from numerical identity.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the last question, and this is more sort of about, for both of you, what would change your mind, I suppose. It's kind of like, well, what do you think would be the most fruitful, what do you think is the most fruitful area of research, the most promising set of considerations that might push you away from the view that you currently adopt?
Hang on, I have lots of views, and so does Rob, I'm sure. Well,
let me
and whether there could be true contradictions, let's say.
I should have built that into the question, sorry.
Right. I'm definitely open to that, at least in special cases. And I sort of alluded to, I think we probably agree on where the main issues to look at are time and change. I agree about the passage of time. That's also a puzzling area. And then the various paradoxes. I think I'd have to be persuaded that a paraconsistent view in the end was the best view, and that it was, the case was strong enough to overcome pretty strong presumption against it.
Okay. What would make me give up my view on dilithium? This, an argument that my views, my dialectic views, commit me to the view that everything is true. An argument for what's often called trivialism. I mean, there are a few philosophers who've endorsed the view. I have a student who wrote his thesis on this. I just find the view crazy. If you can find a good argument that my views commit me to that. Or actually, even a much lesser view that I'm a frog. Game over.
Yeah, that's right. This raises an interesting question, actually, about about theory choice and you know, the role of something like Occam's razor here. Because if you put all your weight in the Occam's razor bag, so to say, or cart, then you could argue that, the simplest possible theory would be that everything is true, right? You make those determinations.
And it's just woefully inadequate to the data.
Yeah, right.
And the most parsimonious that nothing exists. I don't know if anyone's ever tried to defend that.
Well, that's woefully inadequate to the data too.
Yeah. No, people have to admit that, actually.
Well, I want to say thanks to both of you for agreeing to have this conversation. And, you know, I think you've both done a brilliant job at just clearly communicating these ideas, you know, because so much of this stuff, particularly on the purely logical problems, is very technical, you know, and there's dense notation, so forth. And I think just clarifying these things and talking about them in ordinary language and giving people sort of a trail to follow, as it were, in pursuing these things is going to be valuable for a lot of people. So thanks, both of you.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Nathan.
My pleasure. Thanks, Nathan. And thanks, Rob. And I hope that one day we'll have the ability to take some of these discussions further. I mean, it's got to the stage where we need to sit down face to face with a piece of paper. One day this will be possible again.
Yeah, let's hope so. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll just play the closing credits, and then if there's anything that either of you want to say to each other off air, just feel free to hang around for a minute and then can say bye then. But thank you everyone for watching. I've got another conversation tomorrow along similar lines for people who are interested in this sort of thing on Frege's philosophy of mathematics with JD Hamkins. So if you're interested in this topic, you'll probably also be interested in that. So it'd be great to see you there.